Welcome to the court. We have two cases this morning. First one is United States versus Surjack. Because this is a TJAG certified case, the government will argue first. So Ms. Payne, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
And Mr. Spinner, are you prepared to argue on behalf of Appellee?
Yes, sir.
Very well then, please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Mary Ellen Payne, and along with Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represent the United States. Chief Judge, may I please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government's main theory in this case was that the victim fought back against Appellee's non-consensual sexual attack, leaving scratches on Appellee's body and breaking a chair in the process. Yet, the Air Force Court overturned Appellee's conviction for sexual assault without consent because it found that the government did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the victim was capable of consenting. In other words, even though the evidence showed that the victim actively resisted the sexual act, according to the Air Force Court, that evidence may have been insufficient to show that Appellee committed the offense of sexual assault without consent. This disconnect highlights the open question of whether AFCA properly conducted its factual sufficiency analysis.
Counsel,
yes, sir.
You described that as the main theory. Like, I'm reading from the closing here at trial. It's either she was incapable of consent because she was so intoxicated that one of these circumstances you should consider, or what she was, as she explained, asleep when it all started and happened. Either way, the accused didn't have her consent. There's hardly a mention of the scratches. So how do you justify describing that theory as that part of this as the main theory of the government's case?
Well, because I think you have to look at the rebuttal, because in rebuttal
it — is that usually where the government presents its main theory of the case, in the rebuttal?
Well, Your Honor, I would note that in the main closing argument, trial counsel did argue about the scratches and that they showed non-consent, and they also argued heavily about the facts that occurred right before the victim went to sleep, and about how she and Appellee had not known each other before. They hadn't really had any interactions until Appellee called her into the room. So there was a lot of other discussion.
And that was mostly in the context of undermining the Appellee's argument that this began as a consensual encounter, right?
Yes, but that's because this was a without consent case, and that all was relevant, and all the surrounding circumstances were relevant.
Well, that's the government's position now, but like, if I read the transcript, that's not how this case was litigated.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. I think that lack of consent was heavily the focus of
right. Lack of consent because she was either so drunk she couldn't consent or she was intoxicated. Right? At the end, that's what the trial counsel said to the jury. One of two things was true here. Either she was so drunk she couldn't consent, or she was asleep. Either way, no consent.
Your Honor, I disagree with that because I think if you look at the entire context of the argument, what trial counsel was saying was that that was what may have been going on at the beginning of when the sexual assault occurred. But his theory all along was that the victim actively resisted by scratching Appellee and breaking a chair in a fight. And again, when we get to the rebuttal, he clarified what the ultimate theory of the case was. And he said, I may have poorly communicated when I said that either way, when he was saying, making those either way comments, he said, I'll tell you right now what happened. There was a fight in there. So again, that brought the argument back and crystallized it that the main theory here was that there was a lack of consent, and it was expressed through the victim scratching Appellee and then struggling in which this chair was broken. So I think it is very fair to say that that was the government's main theory of the case, and they were not relying solely on evidence of incapacity.
I mean, I assume you're not going to make me read them, but I could go through. I highlighted them all. You know, the closing goes on for a while. Of every time trial counsel said, she was so drunk, and he should have known she was so drunk because of this or because of that. And I could. And there's You're right. He mentions the scratches one time in the primary, and again in rebuttal, more strongly in rebuttal. But I still don't understand how you justify saying that that is the main theory of the government's case.
Again, it would be because at the end, trial counsel says, I'll tell you right now what happened in there. And he walked back his comments. And he walked back to his comments about being incapable of consenting. And even so, I mean, I will note, when trial counsel made that statement, there was an objection. And he said, and he said, I can argue this. This is part of the instruction. And then what he said is that is one of the circumstances that you can consider. But I'd also like to direct your attention, Your Honor, to page 419 through 20 of the Joint Appendix, where he's talking about the lack of interaction between appellee and the victim on the night, the lack of flirting, and the fact that she was mad at him before he fell asleep. And he says, that's the context before she goes to sleep. And it's all of those things that happen before the accused has sex with her. So that is what we have to prove, that the accused committed a sexual act and did so without the victim's consent. So he's very heavily focusing on what happened before the victim fell asleep. And then also a large part of his argument is saying that the victim was angry with the accused. She was insulted by what he was saying because he was making these statements. He didn't even know her. And so he said, why would we believe that she just did a 180 and went from being mad at him to then consenting to sex?
So why couldn't the CCA, in the course of its review, say, inferences need to be drawn here, where we're the government wants us to infer from these scratches. The government wants us to infer from the broken chair. The government wants us to infer from the prior interactions that, in fact, there was not any consent here. But why didn't the CCA have the authority to say, that's not sufficient in our view?
Well, they did have the authority to do that, Your Honor, but if you look at their opinion, that's not what they did. So we look at AFCA's opinion, because I'm sure the Court is interested, was this just a factual determination that we can't review, or were there incorrect legal principles used? But if you look at the exact wording, AFCA starts out on page 22 of the Joint Appendix is where their opinion is. They talk about how our Superior Court recently held that when charging under this theory, meaning without consent, the government must prove the victim was capable of consenting but did not consent. So they lay out what their understanding of the law is, that capable of consenting is essentially an element. But then they talk about what the victim actually testified to. They said she did not testify that she consented to the penetration of her vulva by appellant, as she did not make a freely given agreement to the sexual intercourse. That's on page 25 of the Joint Appendix. And so that could have been more artfully worded, but it very much sounds like the CCA is saying, we believe that she did not give a freely given agreement based on the evidence. But then they say the very next line, however, whether she had the capacity to consent as a competent person is not in the record before us. So that makes very clear, again, that they are overturning this conviction solely on capacity and not because they didn't believe or not because they believed that the victim consented.
Then are you saying that there was a misunderstanding on the part of the CCA about the applicable law?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that they misunderstood Mendoza. And so we believe that there were at least four errors of law that they made in their factual sufficiency analysis. The first was incorrectly treating capable of consenting as an element of the offense that the government had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Secondly, it is unclear in their weighing of the evidence regarding lack of consent whether they truly considered all the surrounding circumstances as the statute requires them to do, because the court failed to analyze the evidence of the victim's physical resistance. Now, third, even if capable of consenting is properly considered an element, AFCA seemed to erroneously believe that the victim has to be capable of consenting for the entirety of the sexual act, which we don't believe is the holding of Mendoza. And fourth, AFCA's opinion seems to endorse the idea that even if a victim physically expresses non-consent, she still must have been too drunk for it to constitute a sexual assault without consent. And that would be an absurd result and inconsistent with the plain meaning of without consent.
So let's break that down a little bit if we could. First one, you were talking about CCA seemed to view capable of consenting as an element. Based on the arguments yesterday in the briefs, you were here, plus in your supervisory role, in your argument here, sometimes the argument almost seems to be couched, even though the argument is that the CCAs misunderstand either Mendoza or Casillas, sometimes there's a little bit of a flavor that we wrongly decided those cases. So I just need to ask up front, is it the government's position that this court wrongly decided either Mendoza or Casillas?
Your Honor, I think it depends on what the actual holding of Mendoza is and whether or not Mendoza intended to create a new element of capable of consenting.
Where did either opinion say that it was an element?
And that's the thing. It never explicitly did, but it certainly
so
seems...
So it goes back to my point. Is it the government's position that this court wrongly decided either Mendoza or Casillas?
Your Honor, if the holding in Mendoza is limited to say that the government cannot prove cannot prove absence of consent merely by introducing evidence of incapacity.
Isn't that what the opinion says?
Yes, Your Honor. So, and I think the government does not have an issue with that holding. We believe it works, but we believe that that holding was improperly applied by AFCA because they do seem as if they're holding the government to a higher standard to prove capable of consenting beyond a reasonable doubt.
So, the government is not pointing to anything within either opinion that this court misstated the law.
At this point, Your Honor, no, but I think some of the language could have been misinterpreted and could be clarified.
It is not a question of our past actions. You're not arguing on behalf of the government that we wrongly decided those cases. The government is seeking a clarification because you believe that the CCA is misinterpreting our decisions. Is that correct?
I think that is mostly accurate, Your Honor. To parse every single sentence in Mendoza and say that we necessarily agree with every sentence of Mendoza, I'm not sure that I'm willing to do that. But again, if the main holding is the government cannot proceed merely using incapacity for a without consent case, the government is comfortable with that being a holding.
So let me ask it this way. If the government in any way felt that we had wrongly decided these cases, why didn't the government raise that issue and proceed through the stare decisis principles and ask this court to reconsider these cases?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think our main...
The government did not do that.
I think our main quibble, again, is with how the CCA is applying the opinion. If we can live with the opinion mostly as it is written, if it is interpreted mainly through the holding being that you cannot merely proceed in and without
consent. So then let me ask you this. What is this specific, precise language that the government is seeking from this court in this case to clarify for the CCAs what the government views to be the correct understanding of these cases?
So, Your Honor, what we would like the court to say is to issue a clarification to say that a reviewing court or even a judge under a 917 motion should look at the question, did the government only present evidence of incapacity in a without consent case? That is the baseline question to answer. If the government presented other evidence if they presented all of the surrounding circumstances and argued all the surrounding circumstances, then the government did not switch theories at trial. There is no due process issue, and Mendoza should not apply. So really, it should be an evaluation of what evidence was presented in this case, and was there anything under incapacity. In this case, the government would certainly meet that requirement because they presented evidence of what happened immediately before the victim fell asleep, and then they presented evidence of physical resistance at some point when the victim must have been able to know what was going on and show her unwillingness to participate.
So let me ask you a related question. One of the central points in these opinions is that a victim must be capable of consenting at some point during the course of the sexual assault in order for the accused to be convicted under B2A. You used previously the word quibble. Does the government quibble with that?
I think the best way to look at the capable of consenting language from Mendoza, or how we would like the court to look at it, is that, Your Honor, it's essentially a recognition that if the government has to produce something other than incapacity evidence, that naturally and necessarily that is going to include some period of the time where the victim was capable. So we just think it's a recognition of what the facts are going to show if you produce something other than incapacity evidence.
I believe Judge Hardy. Okay.
I just want to ask a clarifying question here. So you explained to the Chief what you would like the court to do. Even if we did that, I don't understand how it would solve your factual sufficiency problem in this case. Because in this case, the CCA looked at the record and said, we don't see on this record, and they didn't talk about burden in this section of their analysis or whose burden it was. They just said, when we look at the record, we don't see any evidence that she was capable of consenting during the sexual act. Now, if the capable of consenting can be at any time, then I guess it solves your factual sufficiency problem. But if it has to be closer in time or during the sexual act, I don't see how that solves your factual sufficiency problem in this case.
Chief Judge, I see I'm out of time. May I answer
the
question?
Please respond to Judge Hardy.
So, Judge Hardy, I think that the way that you're phrasing things, that really does make capable of consenting an element that the government had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. But I think that's also one of our problems with why we can't be confident that the CCA conducted its analysis correctly, because the CCA is charged under Article 66 with weighing all the evidence in a factual sufficiency review. And there's no indication whatsoever in their analysis that they considered the scratches on appellee that the victim, according to the government, gave him, and the broken chair, and the fact that there was a struggle. So if they didn't consider that evidence, we cannot be sure whether or not they properly weighed it. And this court should have serious questions about whether they considered all the circumstances and weighed all the evidence, as they're required to do under Article 66.
Is that the kind of probing analysis of their factual sufficiency review? If we don't think they misunderstood the law, is that the kind of probing analysis we would normally do?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say that especially because of the changes to Article 66, and we have to look at the fact that most of our Article 66 case law is based on prior versions of the law, and for offenses after 1 January 2021, this court is now specifically given authority to review factual insufficiency determinations. So although this court in the past has said, well, the court doesn't, the CCA doesn't really need to explain its factual sufficiency decisions, this court should really take another look at that, because if this court is going to do what Congress authorized it to do newly under Article 66, it is important to really understand the CCA's analysis to know whether or not they applied correct legal principles. Because again, our argument would be, as a matter of law, they erred by not weighing all the evidence as they are required to do.
Is there any suggestion in this, in their opinion, that they didn't understand the new Article 66? Didn't they step through what their analysis needed to be, what the standards were, that they needed to be clearly convinced? It seems to me like they were very careful. They took taking all of that into account and explaining how their factual sufficiency analysis had been done.
Well, I would disagree, and this is not in our brief. This is another thing that I noticed in looking at this opinion, preparing for oral argument. But they seem to provide they almost seem to say, as far as making a specific showing of a deficiency of proof, that any claim, whether or not it's a showing, they seem to say if anything is raised, they just use the word claim rather than a specific showing. So I would question whether or not the initial threshold was even triggered in this case.
I think that's fair, the threshold question, but the government hasn't raised that issue at all before this court until this moment, right?
I agree, and it was in response to your question, and it's something that I noticed, but it is a fair response, I think, to your question. Understanding, Your Honor, we did not brief that. But I do think that there is enough of a question, if you look at the entirety of their opinion, that this court can't be confident that they did their factual sufficiency analysis correctly, and if the court cannot be confident, they should remand.
I believe Judge Johnson has a question.
Thanks, Chief. Going back, as has been noted, the arguments from yesterday and the question to me that seems to be at the center of all of these assertions is whether the CCA in fact considered the surrounding circumstances. I think your argument is that to the extent that government put on evidence of surrounding circumstances, that can serve as circumstantial evidence of non-consent or withholding without consent. So the idea being that if the CCA says, well, we have no evidence of showing that the victim was capable at the time of the assault, it's my understanding from the briefs and your argument that, well, yes, there is evidence because of the physical resistance in particular, the surrounding circumstances, which included the events leading up to it and the evidence of physical resistance, i.e. the scratches and the broken chair. And that is specifically what government is arguing the CCA did not consider.
Yes, that is definitely one of the errors that we think that they made, Judge Johnson. It's just very curious, and it doesn't seem to make sense on its face that we could talk about the victim being – we're asking the question, does the evidence show the victim was capable of consenting? And then there's this evidence that she physically demonstrated unwillingness to participate, which is part of the definition of incapable of consenting, so taking the inverse, it just is very curious that the lower court did not analyze that particular fact, and so it should really give this court pause as to whether or not they performed their factual sufficiency review correctly.
Any further questions? Any from this side? Thank you, Ms. Payne.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Spinner. Certainly. Take your time.
May it please the Court, Chief Judge Olson, members of the Court. I'm Frank J. Spinner. I represent the appellant in this case, along with my co-counsel, Major Jordan Grande, it's good to be back before the court again, although maybe I made a mistake yesterday. This is one of those rare cases. I had one before, maybe in about 2004, 2003 before CAF, where I'm tempted to just sit down unless there are questions by the court. Being present and listening to the arguments yesterday, I noted the factual differences in those cases and the legal insufficiency questions in those cases that do not exist here. So I went back last night and I reread Mendoza to see, based on the questions you were asking the counsel, I thought, well, maybe I've missed something in reading Mendoza myself, and I need to be able to really answer questions you may have on that today. And I couldn't see anything in Mendoza that I took issue with or misunderstood. And so then I came back and read the opinion in this case. And as the court well knows, JA 24 and 25, just over one page is the entirety of what the lower court says in their analysis of this issue. And in that one page or so, they say, we're not considering the legal insufficiency. Mendoza was a legal insufficiency case. They said, we're not considering it. I think Casillas was a legal insufficiency case. They said, we're not even dealing with legal insufficiency, and they cite Mendoza and say, we're not dealing with that. So then you go to the rest of the opinion that they write, and the government, I think, read from on page 25, where they make the comment, however, whether she had the capacity to consent as a competent person is not in the record before us. Now, do they cite Mendoza? Do they address Mendoza? No, they say MCM Part 4, Paragraph 60, AG 7A. They cite the manual for courts martial as the basis for making that statement.
But, counsel, I would note that that capacity to consent language is not what's in the definition of G7. It says consent that the person has to be competent. And right. then it goes through sentences about how do you demonstrate lack of consent, that resistance and verbal and whatever. And so an uninitiated person reading that sentence from the Mendoza opinion would say, I'm sorry, from the lower court's decision in Sirjak would say, well, where did they get that actual phraseology? That phraseology is lifted directly out of Mendoza. So although they did not cite it, I don't think it's a stretch to say that they obviously were looking at the Mendoza language.
Well, okay. I'll accept that, Judge Johnson. But I'll take that one step beyond that and say, to the extent it came from Mendoza, did they misstate Mendoza? Because capacity, as I see it, capacity, consent, and whether a person is competent, those are linked together.
Correct.
It seems to me.
Okay.
And when I deal with this question of, has the court established a different element, I think we all agree here that the court has not established a new element of having to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a person is competent. But I see it as two sides of a coin. You have lack of consent on one side, and you have competent person or capacity to consent on the other side. It's just the same coin. You can't get to lack of consent unless it is recognized that being competent is inherent in the ability to not consent. Why the government is here today and why they certified this issue comes down to, in my mind, a very simple thing. The scratches in the chair. They really hung up on that. They're mad because the court did not address the scratches in the chair and say why they were not influenced by that as circumstantial evidence. And what we get down to on circumstantial evidence and surrounding circumstances is inferences. I mean, I taught law at the Air Force Academy, and we had to teach cadets the difference between circumstantial evidence and direct evidence. And the problem with circumstantial evidence is that you can draw different inferences. So the court, and I can only speculate, the government can only speculate, the court may simply have seen the evidence about the chair and scratches and said, okay, a chair fell over. When did it fall over? How did it fall over? Who made it fall over? The government infers that that shows there was a fight. Okay. That's one inference. That doesn't prove their case.
Counsel, can I follow up on that? That's the government cited four reasons that they believe that the Air Force Court had misapplied Mendoza. The one you just described, I think, was the fourth one. Can you address the third one? And as I recall, the third one was that the Air Force Court mistakenly believed that the person, that the victim had to lack consent the entire time, that and that they misapplied this because there was evidence that she didn't consent beforehand. And my question is, do you agree that that's what the Air Force Court was saying? I'll just let you respond to the government's argument. You heard the government's argument. Maybe just respond to it.
Well, it's difficult to know what the court was mistaken about. Now, mind you, they had an opportunity to come back and address this. The government filed a motion to reconsider, and they brought up all these points that they're bringing up here. They brought up in their motion to the Air Force Court to reconsider, and I think it took the court 2 days to deny that motion. So what I would say is that because the government made that argument in a motion to reconsider and the court denied the motion, they had to read all these things to deny the motion, so they considered all these arguments that the government's making. And they said, no, we believe we've done our job correctly.
Let me follow up a little bit on that. Were you here yesterday for the argument?
Yes, sir.
It seemed like the Air Force, the government was arguing that if they show that there was a lack of consent before the person became intoxicated or fell asleep, then the fact that the person became intoxicated or asleep afterwards was relevant because if there was no consent before, well, that consent couldn't change when the person was asleep or intoxicated, and that you're not proving that the sexual assault was a violation of sexual assault with somebody who was incapacitated. You were proving lack of consent, but the lack of consent was established beforehand, and it just didn't change during what they called the gray area. Is that a correct, is that consistent with Mendoza?
Well, I can only go with the facts in this case, and I don't recall there being a lack of consent demonstrated before she fell asleep.
Well, take the government. I mean, maybe the Air Force Court didn't believe it, and maybe we can't review it, but there was the fact that they didn't know each other very well, and she didn't like him.
Right.
And the government sort of drew the inference that certainly you couldn't infer consent from that. So there was no evidence of consent beforehand, and she couldn't have given consent afterwards, so therefore this is a lack of consent case.
Yes, sir. Now we're getting to the factual sufficiency of evidence, because she went to his room. You know, some of these events occur in the female's room. She went to his room, and there's a video showing her level, purports to show her level of intoxication or lack of intoxication when she came to his room. Now, if she didn't know him and she didn't want to have a relationship with him and nothing happened that night that would have made him think that there was an option here, she voluntarily came to his room in the middle of the night. What is it? I mean, why does a woman go to a man's room in the middle of the night?
Well, I agree we can't reassess the factual sufficiency ourselves, but if I think the government's argument was that the court should have considered some of those prior facts in deciding consent, but mistakenly didn't because they believed the only question was there consent at the time the sexual assault actually occurred?
First of all, that's just speculation, whether they were mistaken. We just don't have enough, you know, from what they've written to draw an ultimate conclusion on that point. I just don't think there's enough in their opinion to say they were mistaken. But they did, the government gave them the opportunity to come back and revisit that, and they said no. So I don't think there's an issue of mistaken. And I don't, I think I have some notes from yesterday. I think you were the one that said, didn't you, isn't this the AFCCA saying there was this time between when the piggyback occurred and when the complaining witness woke up and no one knows what happened? And I just think here, I don't believe there was a clear lack of consent established by direct, credible evidence that there was a lack of consent before she went to sleep. In fact, as I was sitting here listening to the argument, my thought was, she came here voluntarily. In the middle of the night, He saw her making out with another woman in the ride back. I don't think he was the driver. He was a front passenger, and she was making out another woman. And I guess afterwards they had some kind of conversation about, well, you know, are you bisexual or, you know, where are you on these things? So if they did have a conversation like that, I get back to the point, why does she go back to his room? And if it came down to a point where she really wanted to make clear, I'm here to just talk about my sexuality, not anything else. And when they finish the conversation, why does she go to sleep in his room? Why doesn't she leave just the way she came? So again, we get into the surrounding circumstances and circumstantial evidence, and I certainly believe that the court looked at everything, and to that point, routine for the court to always finish their factual sufficiency finding this way. But they say at the bottom of JA-25, after weighing all the evidence and having given appropriate deference to the fact that the trial court saw and heard the witnesses, this court is clearly convinced that the findings of guilt were against the weight of the evidence. Now, they're telling you right there, it may be boilerplate, it may be in every factual insufficiency opinion or even sufficiency opinion written by the court, they may just cut and paste that from their last opinion. But they said they did their job. And they do not, outside of that reference that I talked about a few minutes ago on from the Manual of Courts Martial, Part 4, Paragraph 60A, they did not invoke Mendoza. They did not invoke Mendoza. In fact, I came to this argument today. The last time I argued a certified issue was early 2000s, and the government was upset because in that case, it was a U.S. I forget the name right now, but this is just a general illustration. I'm not citing to the case. But the case involved an exculpatory polygraph. And at trial, the defense had offered an exculpatory polygraph, and the judge, rightfully, with the law at that time, said it's not admissible. And so the record goes up. The judge alone trial, former Air Force appellate judge was the trial judge, goes up to the Air Force court, and the court finds, in my case, that the evidence was factually insufficient. And you know why the government certified the issue? Well, the Air Force Court made a reference to an exculpatory polygraph, so they must have considered the exculpatory polygraph in their factual insufficiency finding. The problem with that was the court explicitly said in their opinion, we're just mentioning that this happened in the trial. We gave it no weight. We didn't consider it in any way. And when I argued that case here, after they certified it in this very courtroom, the court looked at the government counsel and said, are you saying the judges are unethical when they say we did not consider the exculpatory polygraph?
Counsel, that's very interesting. But let's get back to this case. Yesterday, the chief judge raised the issue, and I'd like to see if you agree with this, that we exist in a persistent state of non-consent. Do you agree with that proposition?
I don't know what that proposition means. Am I walking around right now in a state of non-consent? I mean, I don't think anybody thinks of themselves as being in a state of non-consent.
Okay.
So that's a term that's hard to resolve.
Okay, then let's go back, because you keep going back to 7, consent. The definition in the statute says the term consent means a freely given agreement to the conduct at issue by a competent person. So, you know, I was an English minor, so we'll parse out this phrase. The term consent means a freely given agreement. That means there has to be some affirmative act, whether it be verbal or, you know, physical manifestation, but which would then mean the flip side of that is absent that freely given agreement, then you're not consenting. Do you read that first sentence that way?
I read Mendoza, and I go
No, that's not the question I asked. I asked, do you read this question, that statement, this line in the statute that way, that the term consent means a freely given agreement to the conduct at issue?
The problem that I'm having right now is you have what the manual says, you have what court opinions say about what that means, and so I'm not going to be boxed into saying, do I agree that just that standing alone without all the court opinions and the other amplifications we've received on that issue, that we just ignore them.
Okay. So I have a second proposition then. Do you agree that there is a presumption of competence, that absence some evidence or showing of lack thereof, that we presume people to be competent?
I'm tempted to get into our political arena about presumptions of who's competent and who isn't. As a general proposition, yes, until somebody does something to show they're incompetent, then I think we recognize our fellow citizens as competent.
Okay. So then the third question that goes to the surrounding circumstances. Is it the defense's position? Well, as I asked yesterday, you said you were here. So is surrounding circumstances cabined? Meaning, do we have to do a snapshot view of the surrounding circumstances, or is it kind of more like res gestae and, you know, the events that led up to it, and maybe even the events afterwards can be considered?
Yeah, I understood the government's argument about snapshot, but that situation does not exist in this case. I mean, if there were a factual evidence of a snapshot, the government would have gotten up today and started arguing, you know, you can't just look at a snapshot, but they didn't make that argument.
Okay. So if we take, we'll assume an arguendo, you agree with the propositions that we exist in a persistent case of a persistent state of non-consent, and that we presume that most people are competent, and that we can look at surrounding circumstances. Is it the defense's position that by introducing as surrounding circumstances intoxication or sleep, that somehow the government has rebutted that presumption of competence?
No.
Okay.
And the reason here, and I meant to bring this up earlier and didn't, but there was an expert that testified about blackout. So if a person is experiencing a blackout, typically in most of these cases it's a female who's experiencing the blackout, are they competent to consent? Now you get into a mistake of fact issue, but in part, but at least I understood the expert's testimony to be that if the female, hypothetically, is experiencing a blackout, they're competent to consent. So then you start getting the question, well, so what is competency? 100% competent? 75% competent? 50% competent? I don't know. But that's the business of the Air Force Court, the other courts of criminal appeals. They have to weigh all these things in. And it's, you know, when it comes to sex and relationships between men and women, and my time has expired.
Let me see if there are any questions from the court. I'll give you brief time to conclude.
Yes, sir. It's just that this court, the courts of criminal appeals, all get hung up on all these little details about, well, does this standard apply? Does this definition apply? And all I can say is this, and it is my closing point. Anything can happen behind closed doors in the middle of the night after people have been drinking. And I think it's very difficult for courts sitting in chambers, in robes, to really figure out what really happened between these two people on this night in their lives. And I leave the court with that to think about as you decide the case.
Thank you, Mr. Spinner.
Thank you.
Ms. Payne.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appellee's counsel just got up here and agreed that capable of consenting is not an element of the offense of sexual assault without consent. But again, as I stated earlier, when we look at AFCA's opinion, the main reason that they overturned this case was because they said, however, whether she had the capacity to consent as a competent person is not in the record before us. And that shows that, as Appellee agreed, they misapplied the law. They treated capable of consenting as an element. And then further, AFCA did believe that there was no freely given agreement in this case. That is what they said. They said the victim did not testify she consented to the penetration of her vulva by appellant, as she did not make a freely given agreement to the sexual intercourse. And then they go into this discussion of capacity, and that's why they're overturning the case. They talk about how the victim did not explain whether the alcohol consumption caused her capacity to be affected. That's also on page 25 of the JA. There was no expert testimony offered at trial regarding what effect, if any, this alcohol had on. So again, the focus of the AFCA opinion was solely on capacity as far as why they found the case to be factually insufficient. And as Appellee's counsel got up here and argued, that was an error because it's not an element of the offense. And so Appellee's counsel also got up here and argued and said, well, we just said repeatedly, we don't know, we're not sure exactly what AFCA was thinking, what they were saying. And so that takes me to this court's previous opinion in Leak, which is cited in our brief. And in that case, they said, we are not prepared to read between the lines of the lower court's opinion and infer application of the correct standard of law, given the importance of this matter of law to this case and to the law generally. And I would say that that's the exact same situation we have here. The interpretation of Mendoza and how it's applied going forward is very important to the military's prosecution of sexual assault. And this court should be sure that the lower courts and the CCAs understand the law and are applying it correctly. And this court cannot be certain that that was done in this case. And that is why remand is essential.
What is so important to the government is that in the future they want to be able to continue litigating these kind of cases as B2A non-consent cases and not as incapacity cases? Is that what's important? Because it seems like yesterday and today, that's what's important to the government.
Well, yes, Your Honor, because I would say that without consent, B2A was the only way that the government could have prosecuted this case. Because the government, and Your Honor, I see I'm out of time.
Please,
may I finish my response
Hardy.
To Judge Hardy? Thank you, Your Honor. The government could not proceed on an incapable of consenting theory because the evidence.
Why not? You spent the whole closing telling people how drunk she was, how he should have known how drunk she was. You could have even satisfied, I think, the mens rea requirement if you'd wanted to. So why couldn't you? You said she's either asleep and she can't consent, or she's too drunk and she can't consent. Either way, it's a sexual assault, right? It's a crime. Now, that sounds like exactly the closing you'd give if you'd charged it under either or both of those two provisions. So why can't the government proceed that way?
Well, Your Honor, I disagree with that because I don't know that the government could have proven beyond a reasonable doubt that necessarily she was asleep or that she was incapable of consenting. But what they could prove is that she did not consent. And that is, yes, Your Honor, that's right. This particular fact pattern, the government would like the flexibility to be able to charge it under without consent and to ask the members to be able to consider all the surrounding circumstances, consider what happened before she fell asleep, consider that period where she may have been asleep or she may have been incapable of consenting, and then consider that period of time where she obviously had capability to manifest non-consent because she did, in fact, manifest non-consent. It's very important to prosecute these cases that we have an option that allows the members or the fact finder to look at all of the surrounding circumstances. And it was the correct way to prosecute this case. The government did not switch theories. All in all, they asked the members to consider the totality of the circumstances.
Any further questions? Seeing none, I'll give you a brief moment to conclude.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that this case illustrates the dangers of overextending Mendoza. We do not want to extend Mendoza to cases where there simply was no due process violation because the government did not switch theories at trial. And so the United States would respectfully ask this Court to vacate AFCA's decision and remand for new factual sufficiency review. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is now submitted. The Court thanks counsel for both sides. And the Court will stand in recess until 10:30.
Court stands in recess until 10:30.